Whitney Media, 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates, on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I am the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming from the studios of WVOX in New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound. It can also be heard live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110. But as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest is Alexander Roberts. Our subject is public and workforce housing solutions to a worsening crisis. Welcome, Alec Roberts, to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you. Good to be here, Richard.
Great. You know, meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy. Housing is one of the most critical elements of public policy that we face, and we have been wrestling with that for many, many decades. Alec Roberts, as Executive Director of Community Housing and Innovation since its inception, has overseen the acquisition of 500 houses and apartments in Westchester, Ulster, Nassau, and Suffolk counties with a budget of over $20 million a year. CHI was cited in 2002 as one of the nation's fastest-growing housing nonprofits by the consulting firm of McKinsey and Company. Alec Roberts founded CHI in 1991 after spending nearly 20 years as a television news correspondent. He was a reporter and anchor in Charlottesville, Virginia, Albany, New York, and New York City. He won numerous awards for his reporting, including two Emmy nominations and the Associated Broadcasters Award for General Excellence in Individual Reporting. He's an active volunteer with community efforts, serving as a member of the Board of Directors of Supportive Housing Network of New York. He sits on the Tarrytown Moderate Income Housing Board and their Environmental Advisory Council. He served as the president of the Westchester Symphony Orchestra from 1996 to 98. He lives in Westchester County. He's married to Barbara G. Roberts, a first vice president and senior financial advisor for Merrill Lynch. They're both excellent tennis players, and I know he's on the court quite often, and he's currently ranked number 4 in the USTA Eastern Division for his age group. I won't mention what that age group
is. No,
was.
Don't do that.
You know, in 2012, the Institute for Children, Poverty, and Homelessness in their September newsletter wrote, and I quote, "The number of homeless families with children has seen generally steady rise despite fluctuating economic circumstances. The U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, known as HUD, reports a 20% increase in homeless families from 2007 to 2010. While this change is sobering, it is hardly surprising as family homelessness has risen for the last three decades. Families constitute an ever-growing proportion of homeless households, and by 2010, more than 37% of the homeless individuals across the country were in families, a number that has increased by close to 40% since 1985. You know, while funding has increased during the Republican and Democratic administrations up to $40 billion a year, the problem has worsened. Alec, how critical is housing to a stable, economic, and balanced society?
Well, Richard, it's an old saying that a human being's basic needs are food, clothing, and shelter. So housing is absolutely critical to nearly every aspect of our society. Stable housing equates to much better mental and physical health and can determine whether or not you get a job. We have a lot of people in homelessness that can't get a job because they don't have an address. I mean, it's a basic need. Studies have shown constantly that people without stable housing suffer from all kinds of depression and other mental illnesses. I got into this business in the late 1980s after covering the so-called welfare motel scandals, and I can tell you that when you see a family stuck in one motel room with a child, it's really a terrible situation, especially when they were all together with other dysfunctional families, drugs, etc. I mean, think about a basic thing, the ability to study. A child has no place to find a quiet place where they can study, you know, for their homework and things like that. And it's really a trauma, and it's gotten worse, unfortunately.
And of course, as we all know, that this has become a multiplier effect regarding crime, poor education, illiteracy, and every other social ill. In other words, when you take away that stable home situation, it's almost a breeding ground for, you know, duplication and problems going forward. You know, following the same theme, in 1970, there were actually more affordable rental units to poor rental households. But by 2009, the ratio of poor households to affordable rental units doubled. In other words, the amount of poor families increased by 75%, and the amount of affordable rental units declined by 13%. Alec, what has been the consequence of this imbalance? Has it added to a new generation of permanent poor with no access to a stable lifestyle? And as I mentioned, does this add to crime and violence?
Well, I really believe that it's kind of a myth that poor people resort to violence. New York City wouldn't have the lowest crime rate of any major city, even though you have tremendous inequality and tremendous numbers of poor people. But the misery of our people, given the squeeze on low and moderate income households because of the high housing, and of course coupled with high transportation costs, especially in the suburbs where we're so reliant on the car, it's making life very tough for those at the lower end of the economic scale. So it is very serious.
Now, following that up regarding why did this imbalance come about, where 40 years ago, almost 40 years ago, more a little more than that, 1970, we really had more units available. What dried up those units?
Basically, it was zoning. The growth of planning and zoning created a police power, which diminished the property rights, which were so paramount throughout American history. You owned a piece of property. You could do what you wanted with it. You could build anything you wanted, pretty much, and very often they did. And while a lot of good things came out of planning and zoning, for example, you don't have a factory, next to a housing project type of thing, or you don't have pollution being spewed into a river. I mean, all of these things have been good. Unfortunately, it allowed people to abuse the police power of zoning in excluding certain types of housing. So you look at Westchester, incredible amount of down zoning, where basically you had half acre zoning becoming 1 acre and 1 acre becoming 2 acre, because my barber tell me, an Italian immigrant, said nobody wants somebody living next to them who makes less money. You put it in a way, but it's a prejudice, it has some racial basis. In some cases, but I don't even think that's the most important aspect. It's an exclusionary thing. People want to have large single family houses next to them rather than an apartment complex. And what's happened is those little decisions made by home rule have had a mega impact on every aspect of our land use.
So as the population doubled in Westchester in 30, 40 years, and more land was taken out of by zoning, and more zoning was made tighter and larger lots, you literally have a squeeze on the ability to create housing for people, right or wrong.
Exactly. That's exactly the situation. It's very simple. It goes back to supply and demand. It's very interesting that many of my colleagues, including us, always talk about lack of housing in terms of lack of money. What do we need? We need to provide more subsidies. It's not enough that HUD is providing $40 billion a year in subsidies. We've got to have more subsidies so people can afford the housing. That's unsustainable. Mm-hmm. And it's wrong.
Right.
Because I believe in the free market system. Mm-hmm. I believe that if the law is followed, and there are state laws and federal laws that require multifamily housing, if those were enforced, you wouldn't have to have quite as much of these taxpayer subsidies, because we're really moving around the chairs. When we give more money to one group, as we have, we provide a lot of subsidies to many families, other families that are making a living and barely getting by, they're squeezed out of the market. So they're ending up homeless.
Right.
So we're on an unsustainable track.
And, you know, getting on this in our last few seconds before our first break, there are 1 million homeless people across the United States. The vast majority of them reside in shelters. In the richest country in the world, is this acceptable? And how do we deal with this? Can anything be done?
Well, I don't think it's acceptable. And frankly, if you ask the average person, I think they would agree at this point. But they don't understand that we're all to blame because of short-term thinking. You know, when the country was established, as I said, private property was king, and you could do what you want with your property. But now, because it is such a litigious and contentious process, look at the Journal News today. There's three stories about different projects, from Echo Bay to a project in Greenberg. All kinds of cockamamie issues are raised, many of them bogus. Like, they're always talking about, oh, it's going to affect the schools. Well, guess what? You know, there are study after study shows that multifamily housing, you know, does not impact the schools as much as single family.
We have to go to a short break. We're coming up on a financial news flash. By the way, you're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM, live streaming on WVOX with my guest, Alec Roberts, Executive Director of Community Housing Innovations. We'll be back in a moment or so.
With business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour, here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, Florida Lieutenant Governor Jennifer Carroll announced her resignation one day after being questioned by authorities investigating an internet cafe she once represented. Florida investigators will hold a press conference at 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time in Orlando regarding that investigation. Google is paying nearly $15 million in bonuses to four of its top executives for their performances last year. According to a regulatory filing, Executive Chairman Eric Schmidt will get the biggest award, $6 million. Schmidt served as the company's CEO for a decade until he turned over the job to Google's co-founder Larry Page nearly 2 years ago. And Nissan is recalling five 2013-year models in the U.S. because the front passenger airbag may not deploy in a crash. The Japanese automaker did not specify to U.S. regulators how many vehicles were being recalled or when they were manufactured. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Adam Shapiro.
Are you uncertain about your retirement account? QE and low interest rates are supporting the stock market. Can it go on forever? What happens when it ends? With billions created daily, in 5 years, what will have more value, paper dollars or solid gold? Do you need to protect your retirement account? Exclusive offer, zero setup and storage fees. Discover how. 800-257-GOLD. 800-257-GOLD. Visit goldworth.com.
No matter where in the world you travel, you'll still be at home when you listen online.
Where am I?
WVOX.com.
WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM with my guest, Alexander Roberts, Executive Director of Community Housing Innovations. We're talking about housing, the homeless, crime, social, societal responsibility. Alec, you are the founder and Executive Director of Community Housing Innovations, which is heavily involved in finding housing for people. You were also award-winning television reporter for 20 years. You mentioned this a little bit earlier. On a personal note, with a successful career in hand, what inspired you to make such a dramatic career change?
Well, the year was like 1988, pretty much, when I was covering the welfare motel scandals for WPIX-TV, including Larchmont Motel. And to me, coming out of a family that had escaped the Holocaust, I kind of saw a parallel between what was happening, especially to African Americans in the situation, since there was the majority were minorities, and especially their children. They literally were being, you know, condemned to a very poor outcomes in their lives. I mean, because housing is such a basic need. And in terms of the news, while I loved it, it was fabulous. I mean, it was exciting. Every day was something new. I would be covering the president. I covered President Reagan, and I also covered the crack house. So one day you're with the president, the next day you could be covering a crack house, and I loved it. But after doing 20 years of this, I wanted a mission that could satisfy my need, you know, to help society, which I really loved. I was more of an investigative reporter. I did a lot of stories that had big impacts, that created, that changed life for a lot of people. But I wanted to find a stable business that could grow, you weren't starting at ground zero every day, right, type of thing.
Right.
And I found both in developing innovative programs for housing and serving the homeless. I had used my television news contacts at the state to look for other answers to providing housing for the homeless. And I found actually one of the most innovative in Westchester County, which had been pioneered by another great nonprofit agency called Westhab, in which they took homeless families and they put them in apartments scattered around in the county. So I started doing that in Suffolk County, and then was able to move to Westchester and three other counties. Mm.
You know, from a public policy perspective, many people realize there is a need for workforce and low-income housing, despite the fact that we have a large glut of abandoned houses as a result of the bursting of the housing bubble and the market meltdown in 2008 and 2009. In this region, specifically Westchester County, what are our needs? Who is taking on this burden, and is there any endemic opposition?
There really aren't a lot of abandoned houses that can help this particular population. Right. That's because low-income people can't afford a house. So that if a house that used to cost $500,000 is now $400,000, it's still not going to be able to help that person that's working at Target to buy it. They need affordable apartments.
Right.
And Westchester is only providing them at a snail's pace. An enormous cost. The amount of subsidy now required to build one new apartment in Westchester County is about $230,000. It's the whole apartment costs about $300,000 or $330,000. It only can carry about $100,000 in debt. So therefore, our taxpayer dollars are subsidizing these units to the tune of $230,000 each, you know, which is huge and not sustainable. So we're basically, in my opinion, I'm a very pro free enterprise capitalist. I really feel in terms of if it's directed properly with strong regulation, that is the area that you allow the private sector to build what needs to be built, and you allow the market to determine what needs to be built. And I firmly believe that if these communities were given targets as to how many multifamily units they would build and put the onus on them to do it in their own way, in other words, some might say, we want to build like zero lot townhouses. Another village, Bedford, might say, we want ours in the downtown. We want to build a four-story building, which is going to have mixed income, mixed use, you know, next to the train station. Do it that way. But until we say to each community that they have a responsibility to provide for a share of the regional need for workforce housing, it's going to be the same contentiousness and tremendous resource use, you know, of taxpayer money.
Now, speaking of the opposition, especially in the more well-off communities, you cite both the Berenson decision and the advocacy of civil libertarians. What was the Berenson decision, and what about the effect of the decline of the traditional family on the poor and the homeless?
Well, the Berenson decision was written by the New York State Court of Appeals. That's New York's highest court, in 1975. And they said that every municipality in its zoning must provide multifamily housing to meet the needs of their people, especially young people and seniors, and that a zoning law that failed to do so violated the New York State Constitution. Subsequent decisions added that zoning must provide a share of the regional need for affordable housing. So that is definitely part of the law. And it's been a critical goal and for the state. New Jersey had the same, a very similar decision. It was called Mount Laurel. The difference is they had a Mount Laurel 2 in which the law was more codified and it was more laid out that every community had to do their so-called fair share. It's never been defined, unfortunately. The legislature of New York has never passed a law that would implement Berenson uniformly, you know, throughout the state. Westchester, under Andrew O'Rourke, did so in setting up a housing opportunity commission that set a housing allocation plan. Each community was assigned a certain number of affordable units to do. And a housing opportunity commission was actually set up to implement this. Unfortunately, in my opinion, the Spano administration and subsequent administrations did not even, or the O'Rourke, had the guts really to basically implement it and to override home rule in this case.
In the last 10 seconds or so, 15 seconds, how does the advocacy of civil libertarians hurt that effort? You got about 30 seconds. How do libertarians, in their sense, prevent some of this from happening?
I don't think it's civil libertarians that are preventing this. I think it's local people who are acting out of fear that... people less well-off than they are going to change the character of their neighborhoods. This is always talked about. Traffic, changing character of neighborhoods, and school children are the three bugaboos that are always raised
right
before.
We have to go to a commercial break coming up. By the way, you're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM, live streaming on WVOX. Richard Garfunkel, myself, of course. One can always call our station, 914-636-0110. I'm with my guest, Alec Roberts, Executive Director of Community Housing Innovations, and we're discussing the critical issue of housing.
National news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
This is a Fox News alert. I'm Chris Foster.
We want to see smoke before we leave. White smoke.
White smoke from the Sistine Chapel means there's a new pope. Twice so far we've seen black, meaning inconclusive ballots. Kyla is visiting the Vatican from Ohio. Barbara here is from Long Island, New York.
We just planned for my mother's birthday, and then we came here and they were voting. So it's exciting.
Fox News Radio's Courtney Walsh is there, too.
Another two votes are expected this afternoon. On St. Peter's Square, people are coming to see if there will be white smoke and a new pope. Ed is an Italian who is rooting for one of the front runners, Cardinal Angelo Scola.
He has a very human side and very open to people.
Vatican analysts are saying that if there is no white smoke tonight, Scola's chances may be fading.
Italy has the most voting cardinals, followed by the United States, 11. 115 cardinals under the age of 80 are casting ballots. This is a Fox News alert.
Ladies and gentlemen, be ready. For the first time in New York, this new show, The Seer, with Prophet Zogo. Every Tuesday at 5:30 p.m., Wednesday 5:30 p.m., and Saturday 6:30 p.m., your life will never ever be the same. So listen to The Scene every Tuesday at 5:30 p.m., Wednesday 5:30 p.m., and Saturday 6:30 p.m. here on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Your life will never ever be the same.
And now with your latest up-to-date forecast, here's Steve Pelletieri's Eye on Weather, exclusively on WVOX Worldwide.
Forecast, Westchester County and the vicinity for this afternoon, mostly sunny. High temperatures will climb into the low to middle 50s. Increasing clouds later this afternoon tonight. Could be a shower through the overnight lows, falling back into the upper 20s. Partly to mostly cloudy. Breezy weather on Thursday, but much colder. Highs only ranging into the upper 30s. North winds gusting to 25. Partly to partly cloudy at night. Lows falling back into the middle 20s, mostly sunny middle 40s on Friday. Mostly cloudy. Chance of rain or snow showers on Saturday. Highs lower 40s. I'm Steve Pelletieri, Jr. reporting for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
We have ways of making you talk.
Well, okay, hotshot.
WVOX Worldwide.
WVOX. to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM with my guest, Alexander Roberts, Executive Director of Community Housing Innovations. We're talking about the ongoing crisis with regards to housing in the New York metropolitan area. We've been focusing on the need for affordable housing, especially with our workforce population and also our homeless. On one hand, we need people to be able to live near where they work. On the other hand, we need to decentralize poverty pockets, reduce crime, get people back into the mainstream of our social and economic society. Alec, what are the benefits of integrating the working poor and blue-collar civil service workers into our Westchester communities?
There are many, many advantages to that. And we've always had some diversity in housing, but with the advent of this planning and zoning and what they call exclusionary zoning, a lot of changes in the character of the communities have occurred. For example, it's very difficult to find volunteer firefighters, volunteer EMS, because they're just, everybody's working so hard, or they're professionals, et cetera. And there are many other reasons. People now like to walk to work, or they can't afford to take a car at $4 a gallon for gasoline. The costs are so huge now in Westchester. Aside from the fact that we have the highest property taxes in the country, it's also transportation. You have to, if you have to drive places, even the train is very expensive. So when you lose, you're losing your young people, first of all. The census shows that in certain bands, like, for example, in people aged, I think it's 34 to 35 to 44, for example, in the last 10 years, we've lost 17% of the population. That's huge. Mm. And there's a graying of the population, we're losing our workforce, and that's a serious
and
problem.
And, of course, you have to, as you mentioned so perfectly, to drive 100 miles round trip at $4 a gallon, I mean, it's confiscatory, the amount of cost for an individual, aside from wear and tear in the car and going to Orange County and crossing the Tappan Zee Bridge and the tolls. You know, New York City's first houses, dedicated in 1935, were the nation's first public housing project. Most housing communities were developed from the 1930s onward, and initial public housing was largely slum clearance, with a requirement insisted upon private builders that for every unit of public housing constructed, a unit of private housing would be demolished. As the first generations of public housing moved up and out, newer generations stayed, and many of these projects became endemic centers of not only poverty, but drug use, violence, and crime. How do we learn from the lessons of the past and create more balanced housing and to avoid these pitfalls?
I really don't like the current model, to be honest with you, of building affordable housing developments. I've said before, I don't think they're sustainable because it's so expensive to build. The other issue, it becomes prone to attacks by the local community that they're not pulling their weight. And in fact, if you look at 100% affordable rental projects, they don't. Very often they don't pull their weight in terms of taxes. A much better way, in my opinion, would be going back to the private enterprise way of doing it, which basically would be have mixed income, mixed use. New York City has it right. New York City has pioneered a model about 30 years ago. It continues today. It's terrific. It's called the 80-20. 80% of the development is market rate housing, apartments, and they reserve 20% in the building for lower income or affordable. And it works great. The people live together. Obviously, the finishes are not quite as good in the 20%, which is perfectly fine. Why, you know, I don't think they should be having jacuzzis for it. Mm. But, you know, you mentioned something about Reagan before, and I knew Ronald Reagan, and I covered the last Section 8 project that was built in 1985. I covered a news conference. It was Malcolm X Houses, and Ed Koch, the mayor, was had called it together to denounce the administration for not doing this. And I walked around there. I was kind of an independent journalist. I really I was scrupulously objective as far as I could be. And I looked around that building, and I noticed the parquet floors and the dishwashers, and I said, and I did the math, and that was one of the first times that I did the math, and I've been doing the math ever since. And I would urge your listeners to do the math, because they would be shocked. They really would be shocked. But in this case, I learned that the cost of building one of those units was so great that you could rehab three for every one. And it confirmed to me that, in my opinion, government shouldn't do anything except for basically things that you have to have, like, for example, security, et cetera. When I say that, I mean it's not the government. They should pay for it. But I'm saying is it should be outsourced. The private sector can usually do better than what the government. I'm for an active government to do this. I certainly believe housing is a right, et cetera. They should make available the incentives and the laws that would produce more social justice in our housing. But it should be done by the private sector.
You know, it's interesting, as you brought up Ed Koch, one of the great legacies of Ed Koch, which is not terribly known, was his $5 billion infusion of money, which actually changed the profile of crime in New York. It had more to do with ending crime than all the so-called Rudy Giuliani roundups, even though that helped, of course. But in a sense, if you give a person a home, or you provide a home, or you allow them to homestead a home and buy into it, they'll take care of that, and they'll have an investment in their community and their neighborhood. You know, a unique U.S. public housing initiative was developed in subsidized middle-class housing during the late New Deal, 1940s, before the war got underway, under the auspices of the Mutual Ownership Defense Housing Division of the Federal Works Agency. These eight projects were purchased by the residents after the Second World War, and as late as 2009, seven of these projects continue to operate as mutual housing corporations owned by the residents. In the same sense, homesteading. These projects are among the few very definitive success stories in the history of public housing. Do we need a program where people virtually can homestead and eventually own their own housing? And is there a formula to make this work?
Well, of course, you know, under Clinton and under Bush, there was a huge effort to bring the ownership society, to let everybody own a home, et cetera. And Community Housing Innovations, my agency, we are the largest provider of down payment assistance. And I'd urge your listeners, we just got a grant of $400,000 to administer from the New York State Affordable Housing Corporation. So if anyone wants part of it, we provide $25,000 down payment assistance to qualified home buyers. And we've provided in the last 15 years 500 of them with the ability to purchase homes in the last 15 years without almost any foreclosure. Our foreclosure rates are less than 1%, which brings up something that I want to say about it. I am very much in favor of home ownership, but not for everybody. Mm. There is a misconception that this crisis and the financial problem was due to low-income people taking on high mortgages, et cetera, et cetera. The fact is that educated people don't make these kind of bad decisions, or very little. All of our borrowers were low-income. Now, low-income in Westchester means a family of four making less than $86,000 a year. So it's not, you know, it's not low income in Sheboygan.
Paducah.
Okay, exactly. But the fact is that they still were. But when we educate the people into, you know, what a mortgage is and what they can afford, et cetera, they make the right choices. And that's instructive as we look at, you know, passing more stringent laws, restricting lending, et cetera, et cetera. I am more in favor of educating the public and letting them decide as adults what they want to do. In other words, maximizing freedom. I'm not in favor of allowing fraud, which went on during this period.
Well,
and of course,
a lot of it was second mortgages and home finance loans, using a home finance loan as a checking account to pay for education. It wasn't really, from what I understand, Barry Ritholtz has written a tremendous article on the housing boom and bust. It wasn't really the underwater mortgages were really not in essence, phony mortgages for people who were poor, particularly in the totality of it, they were a small number.
Right.
And there were people, middle-class people, people with decent credit, taking on too big a burden, having their house prices, values go up, and taking the equity out.
Right.
That had a lot to do with it, too.
Oh, no question.
That's why I don't really particularly blame and throw it at Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And I don't really believe that Dodd-Frank had a gun to the head of the lenders, you know, the unregulated lenders who wrote, I think, 86% of the mortgages.
You're talking the CRA.
Countrywide financial, et cetera. So these people, you know, from my perspective, I know they're a nice kicking boy, you know, to say, oh, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac put the gun to their heads, et cetera. I don't think that's so. But we have to go to a commercial break coming up. And by the way, you're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM, live streaming at WVOX with myself, Richard Garfunkel. One can always call in to 914-636-0110. I'm with my guest, Alexander Roberts, Executive Director of Community Housing Innovations. We're discussing the critical and ongoing problem of housing in the metropolitan area. I'll be back in a minute or so after this commercial break. Thanks.
World and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. Cardinals working toward choosing the next pope as they gather inside the Sistine Chapel outside.
More and more Romans and tourists are arriving here at St. Peter's Square, looking at the most watched chimney in the world. Anne is a Catholic from Louisville, Kentucky, and is hoping for reforms with this next papacy, such as women priests and an end to clergy celibacy.
Fox Radio's Courtney Walsh. In upstate New York, a manhunt underway after four people are shot dead.
Well, we know multiple shootings. One man on the loose. Police are in a massive search here in an area that's normally not used to this type of intense investigation.
Bill Keeler with Fox News Radio affiliate WIBX. And American Taliban fighter John Walker Lind and other Muslim inmates at a federal prison in Indiana expected to be allowed to start holding daily ritual prayer groups. Government had until yesterday to appeal a ruling allowing them. Fox News, we report, you decide.
Under new and top-notch management, Leon's Taxi Service in Larchmont is now Depot Taxi and Limousine Service. Managed by Charlie Scott and Maria Valerio, who are known for their extensive experience in the transportation industry, Larchmont's Depot Taxi and Limousine Service acquired new automobiles and access to new stretch limos, always ready to safely drive you to a wedding, a graduation, a business meeting, an airport, the theater, or just shopping around town. Larchmont's Depot Taxi and Limousine Services welcomes new accounts. If you call them at 914-834-4000, you'll find the number for Larchmont's Depot Taxi will be a number you'll always call when it comes to transportation. Ever reliable. Larchmont's Depot Taxi and Limousine Service is the ultimate in riding with style and with prices which are truly fair. Their drivers are neatly dressed, always anxious to please, and will safely deliver you to your destination. In Larchmont, the number to call, 834-4000.
Praise the Lord, New York. My name is Brother Powell.
And I am Sister Powell.
We are so excited to bring you the Gospel Blend.
Yes, Lord.
Every Sunday, 7:30 a.m. to 8 a.m. on WVOX 1460 a.m. Join us. Worship with us. Listen to the message from Bishop Powell and Pastor Powell from Pentecostal House of Prayer, 94-15, 170th Street, Jamaica, Queens. Matthew 18:20 says,
"For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there am I in the midst of them."
Be in the midst. Join us.
When do you listen?
It's nice to sit back in the car and listen to it while you're driving.
Okay, driving where?
Everywhere.
No reason to reset your preset. Keep it right here. VOX.
WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM with my guest Alexander Roberts, Executive Director of Community Housing Innovations. We're talking about the ongoing crisis, hundreds of thousands of people, millions around the country with regard at not having adequate housing, problems of generational abuse, problems of education, crime, you name it. With and in this, and certainly focusing on the New York metropolitan area, in the late 1960s, Americans engaged in a large urban renewal program that dealt with slum clearance, creating new business and shopping communities, and upgraded housing for the displaced. This program had its critics. Alec, did urban renewal work, and what were its pluses and minuses?
That's a really big question. I mean, urban renewal started in the late 1800s. Central Park was an urban renewal project, and I think we all would agree that that was terrific. Cabrini Green in Chicago, not so much. But urban renewal is a quiver an arrow in the quiver of the techniques of upgrading communities to remove blight and slums, etc. But we've learned a lot. We're not building any silos anymore of these big, like Cabrini Green type projects. We're also trying to have them integrated from an economic perspective so that we don't have all low-income people in the same place. So we've learned a lot, and I am a believer in urban renewal that is sensitive to the communities, and it's not just removing one community to put another in there. But I think we've learned more, and the new urbanism concepts where basically people are building in the downtowns because it's more sustainable. They're building walkable communities. They're putting commercial and stores in the area. This is what young people and many other people want, even older people. They're no longer going for the 3,000 square foot house in the middle of nowhere where they have to drive everywhere. It's changing. The demographics are changing tremendously. When you do surveys with young people, they want diversity, they want walkability, they prefer to live in an apartment with a vibrant community that has cultural things going on. And this is why I think it is so critical that we position Westchester, allow Westchester to compete. We have something like 6 million square feet of office space that's vacant. Employers are not going to be coming here if there's no affordable housing, okay?
Right.
No workforce housing.
Well, in a sense, is they want the new neighborhood, which has been disappeared. It's disappeared in the old neighborhoods and disappeared in Westchester as people can't afford to stay. They want to move, and their children certainly can't afford to live next to them. That's for sure. Other attempts to solve these problems include the 1978 Section 8 housing program, which encouraged private sector to construct affordable homes and subsidize public housing. This assistance can be project-based, subsidizing properties, or tenant-based, which provides tenants with vouchers accepted by some landlords. And there's headlines of last week's Journal News, Section 8, no way out, housing voucher recipients packed into minority neighborhoods. Do we need more Section 8 housing, or are there other solutions that would be more cost-effective, have less resistance from neighborhoods, and lessen the concentration of the poor?
I was a very strong supporter of Section 8. I think now it's critical so that families can afford people of lower incomes. But I have to admit, and I'm a big believer in surveys and evidence and research and science, and I remember when they offered expedited Section 8 certificates to the homeless, et cetera. And when they did a study years later to find out if people with Section 8 worked more than those without it, the answer is no. And that's a sobering result. And frankly, I think the more market-based alternatives where basically you allow the private sector to build multifamily housing will reduce the price. Yes, we need subsidies. There's no question. But I think that there are better ways of making transfer payments to the poor. One way that I like better is the earned income tax credit because it encourages work. It is much less expensive to administer and has shown tremendous success in bringing the working poor into the mainstream.
This reminds me of the 47 percenters. I mean, you're going to get into that. That's a very interesting point on that. From a political perspective, we've seen many calls from the Republican House leadership, especially from House Budget Chairperson Congressman Paul Ryan. He's just for draconian cuts affecting Medicaid, Medicare, possibly Social Security, and for sure almost every social program that for 75 years has been directed to the poor and the lower middle class. His budget just came out yesterday or so. How would these cuts affect our economic recovery?
I think if they're not managed properly, they could devastate it. I really do. I think that we have many, many families already struggling. That said, there is a lot of waste in the system, and a lot of it has to do with some obstructionist by some congressman, et cetera. I was just listening, actually, on the way here to a program called Radiolab on NPR, in which they interviewed doctors on the issue of end-of-life care. And they asked the doctors, well, what would you do? For example, they said, what do you think of CPR? Would you want yourself resuscitated? 80% said no. Would you want to be put on a ventilator to prolong your life? 98% said no. And it's very interesting, whereas the general public isn't aware of this. And there are some in Congress who actually don't even want people to be given the understanding and the information as if they were, quote, death panels, which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. If people understood what they were in for end of life, which one of the doctors called torture, that you wouldn't do this to a terrorist. We talked about the fact that, you know, on a ventilator you have to be paralyzed. You're aware, but you're paralyzed because you would pull the tube out, and it's forcing you to breathe at a rate that's not your natural rate. It's literally torture. Mm. I think that if this were explained to people, and if doctors could explain what their wishes are, it might have a tremendous impact on the price of medical care, which, as you know, in this country is double or triple in many parts of the world with poorer outcomes.
Yeah. Parallel, certainly, and it is way higher than inflation. No question about it. You know, it's interesting as a corollary to what I said. You know, in 1937, there was what they called the Roosevelt recession, where Roosevelt was under pressure of the Fed, the conservative Dixiecrats, to tighten the budget, cut back spending on the New Deal, which, in fact, to all the naysayers out there, the New Deal's statistics on recovery were remarkable in the first 4 years. We were, like, improving 14% a year, not 2%, 3%, 5%. So we had a remarkable recovery from the nadir, the abyss of the Great Depression, which is really, we're in the Great Recession today. In other words, there was a sharp recession of 1937 when they cut back, and Roosevelt immediately primed the pump, and it recovered after a year, 6 months to a year. Now, could we face the same thing, that we could have a double dip if we go ahead and say, well, turn off the spigot? What do you think?
I'm not an economist, but I read Paul Krugman's piece the other day, and he's been arguing for years that you have to, that the bailout was the stimulus was too small.
Right.
And he's looking right, because if you look at what the Paul Ryans and the others who you know predicted doom and gloom about this the stimulus, they're wrong. They've been wrong.
Right.
I mean, eventually they'll be right, eventually, but they're wrong now, and he's looking a lot better than what he calls the false priests that we've been listening to. So I think, yes, we need to control the deficit, et cetera, but this may not be the time. And there are ways to do it by cutting in a smart way and not hurting the middle and lower class, who are really struggling the most.
Sure.
The most wealthy parts, the so-called 1%, have done incredibly well.
Oh, yeah.
And when you compare the how they've done in terms of their income versus the bottom 20%, they've actually lost ground. It's not even, you know, their wages are not just stagnated. They've gone down in the last 20 years, and mm-hmm. that is a travesty. And it's really only to the most doctrinaire ideologue can this be acceptable, mm-hmm. I believe.
I think we'll close on that. I want to thank you, thank my guest, Alexander Roberts, for joining the Advocates today. It's always a pleasure to be enlightened on what's going on in the world, especially so critical to us. If you want to hear this broadcast, by the way, thank you, Alex, for coming here. And if you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocate broadcasts, you can access on my website, advocates-wvox.com, where information, my guest, is always posted in detail. Next week, the Advocates will be hosting Stanley Chow, a Chinese-American who has worked in China for over 20 years, helping businesses in the West understand the unique Chinese culture and benefit from China's rapidly growing economy. We'll be discussing, is China taking over the world? Also, I want to remind everyone that this Friday at Dudley's is WVOX's St. Patrick's Day broadcast. It's been 54 years. It's always a great event. Again, Dudley's Parkview at Hudson Park in Neuchâtel, overlooking the Long Island Sound. Come out. It's a lot of fun. I've been to many of them, and you'll get to meet Bill O'Shaughnessy there. Thanks a lot, Alex, for coming on, and have a great day, okay? Thank you.
Thank you.